wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again on truth2u.org. That's truth number two, letter u.org. I'm Jono, and joining me is Jason Spiritual Babies. G'day, Mr. Spiritual Babies.
Good evening, Jono. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you, my friend. And it just so happens that you and I have been reading the same book.
We have, and it's not the one everyone might be thinking.
Of course we're reading the Bible. We all know that. But we're reading the same book. What do you reckon? Do you like?
Well, you know what? I'm kind of in awe of how this particular book has unfolded. A lot of concepts I kind of didn't really look at before, and it's made a lot of things very clear that perhaps I was confused about before.
Do you know what? A lot of concepts that you hadn't looked at before. When I was getting over the absolute shame and embarrassment of the tradition where I was coming from, it's all come flooding back to me now because of the things that I had no idea about, which I now do. And I have to say, I found it an immensely satisfying read. Our guest, dear listeners, is coming to the end of 10 years as chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte, where he is professor of Christian Origins and Ancient Judaism. He has authored and co-authored a total of 7 fascinating books, among them Restoring Abrahamic Faith, which I know a lot of the listeners are familiar, his latest being the culmination of decades of his own research. And today's topic of conversation is entitled Paul and Jesus, How the Apostle Transformed Christianity. The website is paulandjesus.com. Welcome to the program, Dr. James Tabor.
Thank you, Jono, and thank you, Jason. I'm glad to be with you.
It's wonderful to have you on the program. And look, to begin, in the introduction of Paul and Jesus, it begins by setting the tone of the book with a simple yet confronting sentence of 4 words: Paul never met Jesus. Why did you decide to use this statement as the starting block of your book?
I began the book with those 4 words because I wanted to be purposely provocative, or let's just say thought-provoking. I think readers of the New Testament who are very familiar with the book of Acts might give that a yawn and say, well, of course, Paul had never met Jesus. You know, he was an enemy of the movement and came along later. But believe it or not, as I've given book talks and lectures since the book was published last year, out there in the public sphere, there are quite a few people that have their chronologies pretty vague. Not only, you know, who came first, Abraham, Moses, Noah, mm-hmm. Isaiah, Jeremiah, all that sort of mixed up. But even it just seems like, you know, Paul and Peter, after all, they're both the big statues in front of the Vatican. And then there's Jesus in the middle and the other apostles. Everybody sort of knew everybody. And I just wanted to remind general readers, as well as readers that might already know this. So it really had that twofold purpose. Those who didn't know it, I want them to say to themselves, what? He never met Jesus. Then how could he be an apostle? Because if you remember, one of the qualifications for an apostle, according to the book of Acts, when Judas fell out and they had to choose another one, is someone that had been with Jesus from the baptism of John all the way through his reported resurrection, which is quite a long CV, if you want to put it that way, you know, pretty thorough documentation. So Paul wouldn't qualify at all. And then for people that already knew that he had never met Jesus, I wanted them to think about that, because Paul claims to speak with Jesus and to have revelations from Jesus and to talk with Jesus, and that this is all based upon his own visionary experience. And that comes out, of course, throughout the book. So I just thought it would be a good way to begin the book, to just...
When you say that that Paul never met Jesus, you're speaking about, of course, the earthly Jesus, Jesus who walked the earth. You're not talking about the what Paul commonly refers to as Christ. How are those two different?
Well, for Paul, he puts it like this in 1 Corinthians. He says, have I not seen the Lord? Those are his exact words, 1 Corinthians 9. And then he talks about the other apostles who also saw the Lord. And he's talking about not walking around with him from the days of John the Baptist through the life and work of Jesus, healing and preaching and finally dying on the cross. But he's talking about, have I not seen the resurrected Lord. And he calls him the Lord. I think he does say the Lord Jesus, actually. We could look that up. But for him, it's this transformed Jesus, he calls him the glorified Jesus. He refers to his glorified body. And in the book, I don't use the book of Acts as much as many writers would do. I try to stick with Paul's letters. In Paul's letters, he simply refers to it as seen the Lord, and then that the Lord appeared to me. Mm-hmm. He says that in 1 Corinthians 15, same book. So that's his contact with Jesus. To him, it's, of course, the same figure of Jesus, the human, but he's now been exalted to heaven. He sits at the right hand of God, but he's also been transformed into a kind of a new Adam, he calls him. So he's not a flesh and bones or flesh and blood being anymore. So in that sense, he hasn't met the Jesus, as he calls him, after the flesh. And I think there is a difference.
And there's a huge difference, and so much of your book is about separating the Jesus that walked the earth and the Jesus that Paul portrays. And one of the things that I found that I was relentlessly reminding myself to keep in mind while reading, and as you already pointed out, the chronology, the chronological order of New Testament books, as well, and to keep in mind which of the New Testament books were pseudepigraphical, these are things that helped me in the clarity that you're supplying in your book. First of all, can we talk about the chronological order? I know Martin Luther, when producing his translation of the Bible, he called the Epistle of James an Epistle of Straw because it disagreed with his theology, and he would have left it out altogether could he have done so. But as it was, he placed it in the back of his translation of the New Testament. What is the significance of the book of the Epistle of James?
Well, James, of course, you're talking about two things, really. The order of the books is one thing, Luther putting it in the back because he didn't think it was important. In some of the early collections of New Testament documents, James actually comes first, even before Paul's epistles. Mm-hmm. And that could indicate, in some circles of Christianity as it was emerging, an acknowledgement of James's importance, that you would put him first and put Paul second. But certainly today, Paul is the first one you come to, but he's not the first one you come to if you open the New Testament. So countless Bible readers have had the experience, often growing up, of I'm going to read the New Testament, and they start with Matthew, and they make it through Matthew, and then Mark, and Mark starts sounding like a kind of synopsis of Matthew, which it isn't actually, but you get that impression. And then they read Luke, which is quite a long haul because it's 24 chapters. Matthew's 28, Mark is 16, and finally John, which is 21 chapters, and then Acts, which is, 28, and then you get to Paul. So it's quite a read before you even get to Paul. And Paul then is usually seen as kind of beginning to fill things in, when in fact, I have a chapter on this, which I talk about reading the New Testament backwards. Paul should be first. I don't mean first in terms of influence necessarily, but chronologically, his letters come first, so that his forging of the Christian faith, of the Christ faith, let's call it, Paul's version of the faith, from the Lord's Supper to baptism to faith in Christ, salvation in Christ, many of the things that you find in the Apostles' Creed, this is all coming from Paul, and then it's going to show up later in the Gospel. So you get the impression that it's Jesus sometimes, when it could actually be a Pauline overlay of Jesus. You follow what I mean there?
I am. So if I can just clarify, you would like to see the letters of Paul first because of the influence that they had on the other books, on the Gospels. Chronologically speaking, though, if I may clarify, was James, did he write his epistle before Paul wrote his?
Well, you know, we know so little about James, and we know so little about his epistle, unfortunately, his letter. Critical scholars would even question whether James could have written it, but it's attributed to James, and it is James, the brother of Jesus, the well-known figure who Paul refers to with great respect as being the one of the pillars of the church and really in charge of the community, let's call it, rather than the church, the Jewish community, the Messianic community. And I wouldn't suggest that we reorder the New Testament itself. I think that would be kind of futile. I mean, it is what it is, and it's developed as a historical document. But in reading it, keep in mind that if you're reading Matthew, you're reading a version of Jesus that's been filtered through a Pauline lens several decades after Paul, Peter, James, and all of them are gone. Mm-hmm. In other words, you're reading, I think, a post-Pauline gospel. You're not getting purely Jesus as he was, say, in the year 29 CE. You're getting Jesus theologically remembered in the 80s or 90s CE. You see the difference?
Absolutely.
Just to keep that in mind as you read it. Doesn't mean that nothing in the Gospels goes back to Jesus. Of course, a lot of the Gospels go back to Jesus. But the theology in particular, I think, often can be traced earlier to Paul than to Jesus.
And honestly, that, and I think, Jason, this is what you were alluding to, that's what was so clarifying, keeping in mind the order of books and having Paul first, then coming to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Now, we understand Mark was probably the first gospel written, right?
That's certainly my view. As you know, if you have two scholars, you have three opinions, and they don't have to be Jewish. So to have that division, Protestant scholars and secular scholars also disagree. But that is a consensus. I would feel it quite strongly after teaching New Testament and Christian origins now for all of these years, that it gets more and more reinforced by the evidence for me that Mark wrote first, exactly. Mm. And I don't know where to put James. You had asked about where to date James.
Yeah.
Obviously, if James had anything to do with writing it, it has to be before 63 CE. And certainly it stems from James or from the circle of James. What's so amazing about the book of James is it has no elements in it that you would normally associate with Christianity, meaning Paulinism. Mm-hmm. And I think that alone, in other words, you read, just take the book of James, read the five chapters, and ask yourself, what faith is this? Now, the word Jesus is mentioned two times, once in the opening and once, I think, in chapter 2, about holding the faith of the Lord Jesus. But in terms of the kind of religion that you get expounded in the Epistle of James, you could not identify it as Christian in any way. It sounds a lot like, if your readers know the tractate Pirkei Avot in the prayer book or in the Mishnah, it sounds a lot like Pirkei Avot, very much like it, in fact. You know, just general Jewish ethics about behavior and faith and the tongue and warnings, you know, about morality and so forth.
So it's interesting that you should say that. If it was, let me ask you this question. If it was not for Paul, do you think it might have been possible that, say, a document like Q might have found its way into the Talmud?
Not Q, because Q still is very much coming from the Rabbi Jesus, the teacher Jesus, and it's very much Jesus-centered in that way. I wouldn't think it could get into the Mishnah or the Talmud. But some of the precepts, of course, are in fact paralleled, particularly in the teachings of Hillel, Rabbi Hillel, that's quoted in the Mishnah a number of times. In fact, the contrast of Hillel and Jesus, or even the comparison of Hillel and Jesus, is one of the more interesting studies that have been made. James Charlesworth edited a book from a conference in Jerusalem simply called Hillel and Jesus. Very well worth reading.
Mm-hmm. Pseudepigraphical book. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah, usually you're getting it, yes. Pseudepigrapha is usually the noun, and if you try the adjective, you got to twist your tongue a little more. Pseudepigraphical. Had a couple of drinks, just say in the pseudepigrapha. Don't try the pseudepigraphic.
Now, can you fill us in? Because this was another clarifying concept to keep in mind as I read the book, something I had to continually remind myself about, which really offered so much clarity as I progressed through. What does this mean?
Well, it's confusing, the terminology a bit confusing. If you talk about the pseudepigrapha, That's actually a collection of Jewish writings, most of them before the time of Jesus, that have been collected together by scholars in a modern collection. James Charlesworth, Princeton University, has the most definitive collection of those materials. That would be like books like Enoch and books like Jubilees and the Testament of the 12 Patriarchs. And so that's the pseudepigrapha. Now, mm-hmm. if you're talking about the process of pseudepigraphy, meaning literally, it's kind of blatant, false writing, mm-hmm. it means that somebody writes in the name of somebody else, but that somebody writing is not actually that person. Now, some would call that forgery. In other words, what are you talking about? In other words, I'm writing in Jason's name, and I'm not really Jason, but I want you to think I'm Jason. I believe that would be called forgery.
Of course.
But there is the idea among the academics, at least, that a school of a teacher, let's say the school of St. Paul, in other words, after Paul is gone, Pauline followers and adherents would take his writings and use portions of his actual writings and weave them into narratives and so forth and kind of create things in his name that would then be later taken to be actually from his hand. And so within the New Testament, we actually have four Pauls, believe it or not. We have a core of seven letters, and those are the letters I use in the book, Paul and Jesus. It's really better to stick with those seven, because they're undisputed by anybody, practically, certainly in the academic world. And really, you can get the core of Paul with those letters. So then there's no use in delving into the others. And that would be 1st and 2nd Corinthians and Romans, Galatians, Philippians, Philemon. And what am I leaving out?
First Thessalonians. And that's what you would refer to as authentic.
So those are your
Paul.
Seven. And then you've got another collection of materials that are closer to Paul than the third tier, but scholars doubt whether he wrote them as autograph copies. And that would be books like Ephesians and Colossians and so forth. And so I don't quote or use those just as a matter of method. It doesn't mean that nothing in those books is acceptable, but in terms of a clean method, if you stick with the seven, you're safe. And then you have the third tier, which is 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus, which many, many scholars, even more conservative scholars, would say, well, these seem to be probably beyond Paul's time that they were edited and put together. And then you got the book of Acts, which is not written by Paul, but that's where most people get their impressions of Paul. So think of it as going back to the core of Paul. Or another way to put it, if you don't want to get into textual criticism and all that, is just say early Paul. In other words, these seven letters happen to be the seven earliest materials that we have. And that's another way of thinking about it. And so I construct the entire book upon those seven letters and what they say, and certainly must be getting then at the core message. And then you could go from there and ask about other things if you want to go to Colossians or Ephesians or some of the other letters.
Sure. So those, I mean, the fact that Paul never met Jesus, that keeping in mind the order of the New Testament books and the writers of the New Testament books, the books that we know that Paul wrote and books that we suspect he didn't write, these are the things that offered so much clarity to things that, I mean, as I grew up in the tradition that I came from, James, there was a lot of nodding of the head with absolutely no idea what was going on. Then, as I began to study, I struggled to make Paul make sense. It was just a real effort for me. Then, coming into a knowledge of the Torah, I then had to struggle with holding Paul accountable to the Torah. This is the first time I will say that Paul has begun to make sense to me. And every single chapter of this book, Paul and Jesus, every single chapter there's been a number of aha moments for me, which I, again, as I said earlier, I found so satisfying. Mr. Spiritual Baby's thoughts.
Let's go back to the beginning. I don't want to reveal too much that's in the book because I want people to go out and buy the book. And it's available on paperback now, right?
Yeah, it's out in paperback. Yeah.
Awesome. So we're going to have some links underneath. And
oh, listen. While you say that, I was talking to my landlord dropped around the other day. And he's very interested in topics of religion, and he saw that I was reading this book. He went and got it on, is it iTunes, iBooks, right? You can get it on iBooks as well.
You can, yeah. Simon & Schuster is the publisher. They're pretty good at putting it out in the whole world. Kindle, iBooks, Nook, just about every format.
Awesome. Yeah. So we'll stick all the links underneath, and people can buy in whatever the easiest way for them to do it. Okay. So Paul has this experience, and then he on the road on Damascus, and then he vanishes for a while. I'm curious, because when I was reading the book, what became really apparent to me is that there seems to be a lot of theology and a lot of emphasis on spirituality that we don't read necessarily in the Gospels. So or in James, our understanding of the flesh and blood Jesus in Paul's letters completely changes. For example, it seems to me that when we read James, we have a human who is telling other humans that the end is coming, and the sign of this is the revelation he's had through his experience with his brother Jesus, or his cousin Jesus, we're not really sure. But when we get to Paul, suddenly there's more of a spiritual transformation, and it's almost as if their decisions in their physical lives don't matter as much as their preparation for a spiritual life that's about to happen.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. You know, Paul says we look not to the things below, but to the things above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. So he's got his head in the heavens. He's looking up. He says the things that are seen are temporal, and the things that are unseen are eternal. Sounds a lot like Plato, if you think about it. We call it dualism. It's this idea that this world is just a kind of vestibule of the real world. Remember Plato's allegory of the cave, and that reality is actually somewhere beyond, in a world to come, where we all really belong. And this is actually not the Hebrew view of the world. The Hebrew view of the world, of the cosmos, is that this is in fact a very real world, and this is the arena, Genesis 1, that God created, pronounced good, 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 very good. And it's the place upon which humans are to grow and develop and live out their lives in terms of human history. And so Paul is expecting the end of history. You notice throughout the book, he's looking to the heavens, but he's also thinking that very soon, and I mean very soon, it might have been months or a year or so, he's thinking, the end will come. You'll look up in the clouds, you'll see Jesus in the clouds. The dead will be raised in Christ. The living will rise to meet him, he says, literally, in the air, and so will ever be with the Lord. And you get this idea that it's all done. He even tells people not to get married, don't go into business, don't worry if you're a slave, if you're free, if you're rich, you're poor, you're male, you're female. It's all going to get transformed. So you have to read Paul, every page of Paul, with this huge apocalyptic consciousness, or you're not going to get it. You're not going to get the understanding of what he's really passionate about. And he even says Jerusalem above is the mother of us all, which, you know, if you think about Jerusalem, it's a city. I think all of us, I don't know if Jason goes, how often he goes to Jerusalem. I've seen pictures of Jonah there very recently, where Jerusalem is not the Jerusalem above. It's definitely the Jerusalem below, and the Jewish people who have that land and so forth. So he is proposing something that temporally will soon be finished up, so to speak. Time shall be no more. And horizontally, in terms of this earth, there's going to be a fundamental transformation. He says the form of this world is passing away, 1 Corinthians 7. So you're absolutely right to get that impression. As you read Paul, you get the idea the end is near and you should be looking up. And there's nothing in history then that is really important anymore. Everything is ready to be transformed into this new state. Mm-hmm. He's living right on the edge of that, both horizontally and vertically.
So what I found interesting is that growing up, and my experience of church is that perspective, Paul's perspective, is taken as a given. And as I've started to read the Tanakh, which obviously you're not encouraged to do in most churches, I've come to realize that view isn't shared in the literature. And I've also kind of gotten the impression now that view isn't really shared in Judaism. So it strikes me odd that this Rabbi Shaul, who sat at the foot of Gamaliel, has these very, what appeared to me to be un-Jewish thoughts about the end of time and the latter days.
Well, you have to be careful with Judaism because, you know, Judaism itself from the time of Jesus, let's say the late Second Temple period into the Middle Ages, has its own developments. And there certainly are forms of Judaism that were otherworldly, sometimes referred to as Kabbalistic, mystical Judaism, Gnostic Judaism. Judaism is quite a diverse phenomenon, but so it would depend on what you're talking about. But still, because Judaism is looking back to the Torah of Moses at Sinai, into the family of Abraham, no matter what else it says about the world to come, the Olam Haba, as it's called, or what kinds of speculations there are about the future, of necessity, your feet are still on the ground because of the promises about the people, the land, and the Torah. And remember the refrain of Moses, it is not in heaven that you should go up and get it, you see. He actually addresses that. Mm. Now, as far as the Tanakh goes, the Hebrew Bible, or what Christians call the Old Testament, you're absolutely right. You could not construct from the Torah or the prophets any kind of futuristic scheme that would match Paul. In other words, those things are simply not there. A heavenly Messiah, a heavily apocalyptic view of history. Mm-hmm. It's very much of this world. That's not to say that there are no futuristic elements or projections of the future. Mm-hmm. Towards the end of Isaiah, for example, you do have language about a new creation, a new heavens and a new earth, however that's interpreted. But notice that's in the last chapter, what is it, 66, after all of those chapters, where Isaiah is essentially addressing the people here and now in this world and trying to talk to them about the future destiny of Israel as the Assyrians are battering down the walls of Jerusalem. So there is definitely a difference. And the kind of piety that you have, or the kind of faith that you have from reading the Psalms or reading the prophets or reading the Torah, you could not project into Paul's system very easily without a lot of allegory and a lot of additional interpretation.
And yet, the theologies that Paul comes up with, he's very, very determined, and he seems very, very sincere. And I have to go back to the road to Damascus and ask, in your opinion, do you believe that he actually had some sort of apparition, some sort of heavenly experience? You also go on to speak about his Sinai experience that followed.
Yeah, of course, I'm speculating that it could have been a Sinai experience because I don't know exactly where in Arabia he went, but I think I give an argument that it might have been him trying to touch back with Moses and Elijah in some of the references. People can read it and see if they find it convincing. But he's definitely in the desert. He's there for up to 3 years. We don't know exactly how long, but he has this encounter with Jesus. I, as a historian of religions, I really try to avoid passing a judgment on somebody else's religious experience. Mm-hmm. I'm more interested in recording and observing what they claim. So if we were talking about Joseph Smith or Muhammad or Paul or Joan of Arc or any visionaries or even Isaiah or Jeremiah, rather than say, do you think they were valid or were they crazy or whatever, because you know, that's for people to decide based on what they read.
Sure.
I would rather talk more about what he says he saw. In other words, what does he say he what does he report that he saw, and what ideas came from it? So that's what the book is about. Because I wanted the book to be somewhat neutral. This is not really a Paul bashing book. I know some of the readers who read this book come away saying, okay, you know, Professor Tabor doesn't care much for Paul. He's more of a Torah-oriented person, which I am, and which you know from my other books, particularly Restoring Abrahamic Faith, which is more of a personal manifesto of what I actually think. So they read Paul with that lens in mind, but I'm telling you, other readers of Paul, other readers of the book, have said to me, you know, you got Paul exactly right, and guess what? I believe him.
Mm-hmm.
And so they actually see the book as enforcing, rather reinforcing their faith that the revelation Paul got was in fact correct, and I just gave them a real clear exposition of that revelation. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. So, and I wanted it to be that way. In other words, I wanted the book to be Paul in his own words. Like him or lump him, what did he really say? What was he all about in his own time and his own words? And that's what I tried to do. And I didn't want to, at the end, say, and by the way, I think this is a really ridiculous thing that he proposed here or there or whatever. Mm-hmm. But he does seem absolutely convicted and sincere. So how do you explain the religious experience of anybody? People come up with all sorts of visionary experiences, mm-hmm. some of which I consider valid and others of which I don't. But for me, personally, if you're asking me personally, I want to go back to the Torah and the prophets as a kind of a benchmark. And since the proposals mm-hmm. Paul makes are so radically beyond those things, they don't draw me personally, but like sounds like both of you, I grew up in a tradition where Paul was it, believe me. Mm-hmm. I mean, if Paul said something, you know, we had these ads years ago when E.F. Hutton's is mentioned, everything gets silent. That's how it was in the churches, and it still is today in many churches. All you got to do is just quote Paul. You know, Paul said this, Paul said that, mm-hmm. Paul said the other. It's as if Moses is speaking at Mount Sinai. This is Paul. Mm. And I was raised in a tradition, the Churches of Christ, in which Paul is absolutely the dominant influence and force. And I think that's the case with Augustine, with Aquinas, with Luther, certainly, most of the Protestant and Catholic great thinkers and figures. They're deeply, deeply influenced by Paul. The creeds that Christians quote are influenced by Paul. And so he's very important for us to get a handle on for that reason.
So when you say, I mean, in the title of the book, Paul and Jesus, How the Apostle Transformed Christianity, you're speaking about the transformation of a Jewish expression into what we now know as Christianity. So in a sense...
Yeah, it's a little tricky. You know, again, the publisher, Simon & Schuster, they finally come up with titles. And what I didn't want to do is Paul and Jesus, How the Apostle Paul Perverted and Destroyed the Message of Jesus. Didn't think that would be a good move. On the other hand, putting Christianity there for people that are well-informed about the history of the faith, of the Jesus movement, it's a little bit misleading because there is no Christianity in the time of Paul, really. There's not the religion that later develops into the new third religion, the new world religion of Christianity. But you've got it exactly right. You were able to read that title and discern what we really mean. Is there is Jesus and whatever he taught that we could loosely call Christianity, maybe in scare quotes, and then there's Paul who transformed that. So the question is, how did he transform it? And notice, transform is a fairly neutral word. It could even be mm-hmm. a positive word mm-hmm. if you like transformations. Mm-hmm. But if sure. you don't think things should be transformed, if you think something is perfectly fine the way it is, then transformation could be seen as a as akin to some sort of apostasy or something like that. So
sure, and then of course it certainly raises the question. It raises the question: what was it before Paul got hold of it and was victorious in furthering his theologies? What were his doctrines? What was it before then? Can we say with any certainty that it was like XYZ?
Well, I think it really turns so much on our what we call our quest for the historical Jesus. This is this enterprise for the past 200 years that scholars have been engaged in taking the Gospels and other materials, but primarily the Gospels that we have in the New Testament, reading them critically and trying to discern what can we assuredly know about Jesus as he actually was as a historical figure, and peeling away some of the theology and some of the tradition that was added later. Mm-hmm. It's not a perfect science by any means. Some would say it's not a science at all, but it does have a method to it. And you can read some of the major books. I've written my own book called The Jesus Dynasty, where I offer my own take on what Jesus was like. But once you get that Jesus to your own satisfaction, what you think Jesus most likely was all about, what his core values and teachings were, then you could make a comparison with Paul. If you went strictly by the Jesus, let's say, of the Gospel of John, particularly in the red letter portions of John, he's going to come out very close to Paul, because the theology of John has a lot of parallels to the theology of Paul. You got this preexistent Son of God who takes on flesh. John says the Word became flesh. Paul says Jesus, you know, took on the flesh in Philippians 2. And he dies on the cross for the sins of the world, and whoever believes in him will be saved. He's resurrected from the dead. He ascends to heaven and is returning again and so forth. That sort of pattern is in John. It's here and there in some of the synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, but not as strongly, and certainly in Paul. So it really depends on what Jesus you start with. My own take on Jesus is that he is not a Pauline Jesus. In other words, he's not the Jesus of Paul. He would be the Jesus that we get pictured more in the book of James, or you referred earlier to the source we don't have anymore, but it's embedded in the Gospel of Luke, a collection of the sayings of Jesus that scholars refer to as the Q source, that was made before the Gospels were written. If you, I have some of that in the book at the end. If you take those things and the book of James, you get a Jesus that really fits pretty well into the Judaism of his time. He's clearly messianic. And by the way, I should clarify, because I know you have lots of listeners out there that talk about, you know, Jesus is Messiah, and was he the Messiah, or who is the Messiah? I saw you had Rabbi Eli Cohen on recently talking about some of that. When I say messianic, I simply mean the notion that of a movement within Judaism that would think that its leader was, in fact, the promised one. And so it could be the Jesus movement or any other movement, as opposed to a movement in Judaism that has not chosen such a figure. For example, we would not call the Pharisees, from what we know in the first century, as messianic, because they don't have a candidate that they're putting forth and saying, hey, this guy is it. I think we would call the Qumran community that wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls, we would call them messianic, because they have this teacher of righteousness that they do consider to be anointed of the Spirit, in teaching the mysteries and ushering in the end. So that would be a messianic group. So I'm just saying messianic doesn't necessarily refer to Jesus.
Deciphering between the lines, it seems fairly obvious that Jesus, Yeshua, was a Torah-observant Jew, zealous for the Torah of Moses. You outline, one of the chapters of your book, outlines the difference between the Torah of Moses and Paul's Torah of Christ.
Yeah, I think for Paul, I mean, he makes it pretty clear that for Gentiles, without any question, he does not want them being circumcised or converting to Judaism or taking on what he calls the whole yoke of the law, which is exactly what young men and women do at age 13 in Judaism. They take on the yoke of the Torah, and he doesn't want them to do that. The controversial part of my book would be, is he also proposing that Jews would not need to do that in order to be pleasing to God, that they can have a, that Jews also can be part of a kind of a new covenant in which they would follow a new Torah that's greater than the Torah of Moses. And I believe that Paul set forth all of those things, that he has a new covenant and a new definition of the people of God and a new Torah and a new definition of the land. He says Jerusalem above is now where we look, not Jerusalem below. And so he's actually taken all of the major elements that we associate it with Judaism and transform them in a way that I don't think we could possibly trace back to Jesus.
I find that actually very interesting. In the Gospels, we read that Jesus gave the great commission to go out, not to the nations and to the Gentiles. And that generally speaking, Jesus keeps to the Torah. And here we see Paul absolutely doing the opposite. And but still claiming to maintain a communication with this new spiritual Jesus.
You do have in Matthew, Jesus says, don't go in the way of the Gentiles, and he's only come for the lost sheep of the house of Israel. But at the end of Matthew, you remember you have the so-called Great Commission where he tells them to take the message to the nations. But one of the problems is, this is being discussed recently in several dissertations. Jason Staples is a scholar at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's writing under Bart Ehrman, and his dissertation argues that when Paul in Romans 9 through 11 is talking about going to the Gentiles, the not my people, lo ami of Hosea, that he really is thinking of gathering the tribes, the lost tribes, that they're Gentiles, they become Gentiles, but
they're
actually
in the nations, but they're actually
they're in the nations.
They've been exiled. Yeah.
So when Jesus in Matthew says, "Go and preach the gospel to all the nations," it can be understood as, "Look, the tribes have been scattered throughout all the nations. You need to go gather them back." Then you open the book of James, and what does he write? James
to the 12 tribes abroad.
The 12 tribes scattered abroad, and then Peter. First Peter is very interesting. He says to those of the dispersion, which is the normal term for the scattering, and then he starts talking about don't live anymore like the Gentiles. He uses that term several times, and he says you were once not a people, and now you become the people. So in the past, that's always been seen by everybody, I think, as, oh, well, they're just taking the language of Hosea and allegorizing it to apply to ordinary Gentiles that don't know God. But I'm not so sure they're that sloppy with their exegesis. I don't think they are. I think they might have had in mind, among the nations, pulling in these scattered Israelites. Now, that wouldn't mean that Gentiles don't come in as well. Remember when the prophets picture this regathering, this messianic regathering, you always have, I will gather others than those that are gathered. So Israel and Judah come back, or actually Judah and Israel is the order that's normally given, like in the book of Zechariah. Judah, the Jewish people, and then the scattered Israelites. But then Gentiles come as well. And I think that's kind of what Paul might have had in mind.
So this brings me to the, I don't know that we had time to look into this right now, but you do make mention of Galatians in your book, where Paul publicly rebukes not only Peter, but Barnabas in regards to eating with the Gentiles or eating with the Jews. Would you be willing to come back onto the program and talk about that in a little more detail?
I would, and I think, you know, the real question that we might explore that would have very much to do with that is there's not a lot of disagreement among scholars or general Bible readers if you read the book of Acts and what Paul himself says, that Gentiles are not required to keep the Torah, or let's just say to convert to Judaism, to become Jews, in order to have favor with God. And Paul would agree with that, and Peter would agree with that, and James would agree with that, according to all our sources. So the real question is, what I alluded to earlier, the real question is, did Paul, maybe not openly, but if you got him alone in a corner and pressed him and said, look, I really want to know what you think. I'm Jewish, but I've had this new faith in this Christ figure that you preached. Is it really necessary for me to keep the Jewish Torah, even though I was born Jewish? What would he have said? In other words, was Paul perhaps teaching Jews also that the form of this world is passing away? Yes, but also that the covenant of Moses is fading away. I answer that in the book, and I won't give you the answer right now over the air, because if we do another program, I want people to
cliffhanger.
Do what we say.
That's a cliffhanger. This takes us in Acts when James approaches Peter, Paul, and says, "Listen, dude, there's some rumors about you, and it's not good. Can you go and shave your head? Go and offer a sacrifice, and go and just show everybody that it's all okay."
And Paul doesn't answer. He doesn't say anything.
He's not conclusive. So we definitely have to pick up there, and that is also relevant to the book of Galatians. Looking forward to speaking with you again, my friend, and thank you so much for coming on to Truth to You for the first time. I can't believe it took this long. Jason.
Yeah, I just want to thank you, and I can't wait to come back and explore those things, and especially the relationship between Barnabas and Paul and where that went from there, because that's going to be dynamite.
Okay, very good to be with you both, and look forward to speaking further later.
Absolutely looking forward to that, and the website is www.jamestabor.com, jamestabor.com, and the book, of course, Paul and Jesus, How the Apostle Transformed Christianity, paulandjesus.com is the website where you can find the links and purchase that in various forms. Highly, highly recommend listeners do so. And I will say again, an immensely satisfying read. So clarifying, absolutely clarifying. And I highly recommend that you get a copy and read it, because you want to keep up with what we're going to be talking about. So do it quickly. So thank you once again, James Tabor, Mr. Spiritual Babies. Thanks for coming back on the program. Until next time, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's Word. Shalom.